Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Poddleters. In this episode, I speak to Jason Ukundaya. Jason is a freelance journalist and he is currently writing his first book, Revolutionary Acts, Stories of Love, Brotherhood and Resilience from Black Gay Britain. We discuss the three things he wishes he'd been taught in school, namely social history, media and media ethics, and public speaking. And we speak a bit, or a lot, I'm not sure, at the end about identity politics and how our attitudes towards them and the privilege discourse are changing, which I personally think is quite an interesting topic, as adulting and the conversation I've had on here have centered themselves often around those things. And it's kind of interesting and refreshing, I think, when you start to grow out of or grow beyond a belief and start to think maybe that it's time for the conversation to kind of change. I hope you enjoy listening to that. I found it an interesting conversation and I still can't believe that we're on episode 101. Wow. Well, enjoy. And as always, please do rate, review and subscribe. Bye. Hello and welcome to Adulting. Today, I'm joined by Jason Ukundaya.
Hi there, I'm Jason Ukundaya. I'm a writer and journalist who is based in South London, and I'm also the author of the upcoming book, Revolutionary Acts, which is a social history of Black gay men in London, specifically South London, because that's my beat.
I love that. I mean, first of all, congratulations on your book. How are you feeling about that?
Thank you very much. I'm very excited for it, but I also know that it's like a huge responsibility, because I think in some ways it's kind of the first book in its kind, purely in terms of charting this kind of history. And it's, you know, it's a story that's based in Brixton, and it looks at the lives of six different Black gay men in terms of their activism and their relationships in different parts. And I think it's part of my mission to kind of really bring Black British gay history to the forefront and tell a very different story of the nation, to look at what was happening to, you know, certain demographics under the Thatcher years, throughout the 90s, throughout the early 2000s, because I think these are stories which are not necessarily marginalized, but just not even thought of as things that matter. And I mean, we know that these years were difficult for Black people and difficult for queer people, but we don't think about those who are caught in the middle.
I think that's so true. I guess it's kind of like, is revisionist history, I guess, the right way of framing it? It's going back and like re-getting those stories that just haven't been given any airtime previously.
Yeah, exactly that. And I'm really enjoying the process. I mean, I'm at the research, very early research stage still at the moment. And I think what I'm liking is that I'm just developing friendships with all of the men that I'm speaking to, because I want to, you know, I want to be comfortable with them, and I also want them to be comfortable with me. I don't want it to be a process where I kind of just come in, interview them and then go away and write the book. I want it to be like really involved and engaged and mutual. So yeah, it's been a real blessing to my life, not just the book itself, but also the kind of networks and relationships it's allowed me to form with a entirely different generation of men like me.
I imagine that must be really emotional. Like what is the response when you reach out to these men? Are they sort of like so excited to be featured? Do they feel grateful? Is it like kind of alien to them? What's their kind of reaction been when they've found out that you're kind of delving into this history that they lived but maybe never saw?
It's a little complicated. I mean, they're always very enthusiastic. I think in some parts it's also almost an admission from some of them where they've said, you know what, we've been really bad at recording and sharing our own history. So it's kind of good that you've been curious and you've come in, because there was almost a kind of fear that, you know, no one would have done it. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of these guys are, I mean, I think the oldest is 71 and the youngest is 51. And the history, it's been recorded in some places, in like some archives and some, say, articles or interviews, but it's not been like a cohesive story told. And I think that they've all individually said, you know, they've been interested in like developing this kind of story, but no one's actually done it. And I think that it's good for them for it to be in the hands of someone who wasn't part of it, but has like a stake and interest in it, and is able to really mutually go through the memories and the history and really interrogate it and also challenge it in some ways, because I mean, the kind of circumstances that they were living in and the kind of organizing that they were doing are actually vastly quite different to the circumstances we live in now. And what's great is that it means that they, whilst I have so much to learn from them, they also have a lot to learn from me. And so it's a really mutually beneficial relationship.
Because I've obviously followed, you have your Instagram account, that's, is it Black and Gay Back in the Day? Is that what it?
Yes,
and that's going to be the same as, and so that, did that, when you started that, which was quite recently, wasn't it? Was it this year or?
Yeah, that was in February.
Was that just like a personal passion project that you were like, I'm going to start, I really want to find out about this, get into the archives and discover these stories, and then the idea for the book was sort of born out of that?
Actually, no. So the book came first. So I've been working on the book since last year. Honestly, it was such a long process. I don't think people realize how long it takes. I mean, I didn't realize how long it would take. I mean, I got signed to my agency in June of last year, I think, and I started working on the book proposal quite soon after. Once I established what I wanted to do, I started working on it properly from around September, and I thought it'll be fine. I'll get it done 2 months, easy. And God. So many rewrites and having to, you know, structure it and figure out how you're going to bring together these people's stories and make it into like a cohesive narrative, and figuring out how much of myself I wanted to put into it and how I wanted to write it. It was actually very tough. It was really tough, and it took months to develop. And the archive actually happened quite randomly. I mean, I think initially it was Mark Thompson's idea. Mark Thompson is the person who I work on it with and who's one of the key people who is in the book. And he had originally set it up himself because he just had the idea in the shower. And I kind of saw it. I'd actually been thinking about doing the same thing, but I just hadn't ever put anything to action. I remember I had like a little, you know, when you create an Instagram account blank and you just save a name, and I had it there. And I basically messaged him and I was like, let's do this together, actually, because first of all, you know, I have the Instagram skills, because I was slightly horrified about the way he was cropping things and sharing things on there, which we both laugh about, and I was like, I'm gonna make this a bit more savvy. So yeah, we then launched it together, and it got a really remarkable response. I don't think we expected the response that it got, and it also, I think importantly, it showed like actually people are really interested in this and they're really keen on this, and it's not just Black people, it's not just Black gay people, it's not just gay people, it's lots of different people just found it really fascinating and thought that the stories we're sharing were really wonderful, and they thought the pictures were really intimate. And yeah, it then led to lots of different editorial opportunities for Mark and I, and it was just a wonderful project to have worked on, and it happened completely randomly. But yeah, I think some people assumed that the archive came first, then I had the idea of the book, but no, the book has been like ages in progress.
Right, I see. Yeah, so I didn't know that, because obviously I didn't realise until I think you announced your book that was coming. But I think it is a really important thing too. And this is such a simple thing that you said earlier, which I think is really interesting. We talk about like intersectionality, and actually it's a really problematic part of what happens, where we divide people into groups and forget how many like crossovers there are in that Venn diagram of like people are like, oh, you know, like someone who's queer and someone who's Black, and they never really, as you said earlier, recognise that there's so many instances in those little intersections that we have of like identity politics that actually have huge crossovers, and then people don't, they seem to forget to look in the, what are the crossover bits in a Venn diagram called?
God, I'm not a math person, so I have no idea.
But you know what I mean from that description.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I guess that kind of leads us on to, but tell me if I've completely misinterpreted, if this what you were saying with your first thing that you wish you'd been taught in school, which is about social history, which I've interpreted to mean sort of the way that society, identity and people interact. But please tell me if you meant a different thing.
No, I think that's broadly correct. And what I mean by that is that I think social history is also sometimes called the history from below. And it looks at the lives of ordinary people and the, you know, effect that the state perhaps has on their lives, and how they interact with each other and how they build communities. And basically, it makes me think about what defines a lifetime. And it's not necessarily the activities of the state. It's, you know, the people below who live under it. And I remember at school, all of the history, I just remember everything I learned was military history. I went to a really weird private school where they were just obsessed with all of the world wars. It wasn't the bulk sum of what we learned, but it was royal history, military history. We would only learn about, you know, certain political royal actors. And I remember always thinking, why did these people come to represent the nation? And why do these people come to represent what we describe as, you know, British history or American history or whatever? And why can't we learn about the lives of, you know, people who have been on the ground? Because I think that if you were to look at your own individual life and the kind of life that you've known and the communities that you've been around, you wouldn't just define that by what was going on at the very top level. You'd define that by what was going on the ground. And I also think that sometimes you get the most interesting stories there. Now, there's some bits of history that I really like that look, you know, royals or wars or stuff like that. But I also just find a lot of it, really dry and really boring and really detached. And it kind of made you forget about the fact that, you know, there were millions of people implicated in these different power struggles between, say, different European powers or whatever. And yeah, that kind of engineered my interest in actually getting to these stories and legacies that exist. Because I think part of the way I think about it is that the most interesting and inspiring historians I know are always, you know, members of my family or friends who are older than me and who are able to narrate their lives with significant clarity. So someone who is in the book, but I also interviewed for the Guardian's Black Lives series, Ted Brown. I remember when I wrote that editorial for him, we had been on Zoom for 3 hours and he just narrated his life from beginning to end. And honestly, it was one of the most fascinating pieces of history that I'd ever witnessed. And the fact that I had to get it down to like 2,200 words was obscene. I mean, people really praised that piece and I had to be like, this was like 5% of this guy's life and what I'd been told. I just literally had to cut it down so much. There were stories of really remarkable people which are actually a lot more interesting and also tell you a lot more about the nation, about history and about how people lived than the kind of text we're learning that we get in schools. So yeah, I kind of wish that, you know, we were encouraged to look more and study more, think more about the everyday person and thinking of a way to capture these people's memories and histories and incorporate that into how we study and think about history is really important.
I completely agree. And I think that I had that same kind of like abstract feeling towards history where it just sort of felt kind of irrelevant to me and overdone and just sort of, I don't know, I never really meshed. I'm really upset. I kind of dropped history when I was quite young because of those exact feelings where I just kind of, like, I don't know why I'm here. I'm really not interested in like the Battle of Hastings or whatever we're learning about. Whereas actually then, as you said, I remember having really similar conversations like with my grandmother about when she moved over from Ireland to the UK, like to London, and sort of like her own personal history, grew up in Clapham and like what the world was like. And I was like, God, this is fascinating. Also, this has happened like in the last 50 years. And this has told me more about society, culture and, you know, the cultural climate of what it was like back then I've learned in my whole school experience. And it is fascinating that we sort of, now we definitely do it in this think piece and you write definitely great articles where I was just saying before we started recording a really good piece that you just did with some young girls talking about, you know, how do they feel that their lives are going to be when they finish school, where are they going to live? And it was really, I felt like I got such a well-rounded, interesting perception of like what teenagers and younger people are thinking living in London that I ever would have done when I'm sure in 20 years time we'll read a think piece about, you know, what it was like to be in London during this pandemic. And it probably won't have anywhere near as much flavour or like perception as that piece that you did.
And it's really important to know, like, what is it like to live through history? I mean, we always, you know, say that we're currently living through history with the pandemic, with Brexit and things like that. And I feel like the history books, all they're going to talk about is, you know, the different political actors. I mean, when we look at the history of the pandemic, obviously what's going to be focused on is, you know, Boris Johnson mismanaged it, but he still managed to do really well politically. And questions about, you know, did the pandemic sink Labour and blah, blah, blah. And obviously those are, you know, particularly relevant, but they don't necessarily exist in our everyday socializing. I mean, I'm someone who, you know, talks and thinks about politics a lot, but it doesn't define my life. And I don't know whose lifetime is defined by just what's going on above them. So yeah, I think that day's piece, you know, when I spoke to these teenage girls, it was really wonderful. And it was also a little sad, you know, when they spoke about the reality of what it was like being a teenage girl in London, the effects of the pandemic on the cityscape and how they felt that, you know, gentrification, the increasing hostility of the city in many ways, including like pollution, a lack of social spaces for young people and things like that, and how the city's been decimated by austerity, has a real impact for them and, you know, might influence, you know, where they decide to move to in the future. And I think that sometimes we might just get statistics where it says, you know, this percentage of people have moved outside of London, and you can't get kind of like headline answers being like, oh, people have moved for greener stuff or for work, but you don't actually get into the nitty gritty emotional reasons for why people might be deciding to move on from the capital. And that is living through history, and that is as much a history of the nation as whatever Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer are doing.
in a funny way, I guess, like in your book, I mean, you said you haven't said how much you haven't decided exactly how much yourself you want to give away, but this, it'll be an incredible piece of your own sort of history and lifetime. Do you feel nervous? Because I didn't realize, I for some reason thought you were the same age as me, but I think you're a little bit younger. Do you feel nervous about how much you want to say or how much you want to tell of this portion of your life? Do you feel like it's going to be very soul bearing, or are you quite excited to document and archive these years, which are like super formative?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think that I'm still not sure about how much of myself I want to put into it, because, you know, I definitely want to put myself in dialogue with the different men and kind of have that intergenerational discussion and emphasize those elements. But I also I'm so cautious and worried about how much of myself I'm going to end up putting into it and then reading it back and being like, oh gosh, you know, this was really exposing. In terms of the kind of like raw emotion of what I'm detailing, and also the kind of comparison of experiences as well. I mean, one of the chapters that I have is going to be looking at homophobia in the media and the ways in which, you know, activists organise against the media as well. And I've had my own troubles with media when I was a young student, where there was instant over some tweets, which I can't be asked to repeat, back in 2017 it was, and the stories that were written about me ended up outing me to a lot of family members who didn't know, and that was actually quite awful. And then that experience kind of reminded me of what some of the men were sharing about the ways in which the media used to conduct themselves and the way that they were kind of forced to disclose in certain different environments, not just media but also, say, police stations or at hospitals, about their sexuality or about, say, their HIV status or things like that. So I kind of thought, like, as much as, you know, there is some significant difference in the media landscape, and I won't pretend that it's identical, it was interesting how much I was able to relate with some of their feelings and experiences.
That's so terrible. I saw an article about that time when that happened to you, which I think you wrote, and it sounded like one of the most difficult things. And I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit actually when we come on to your next topic. But I'm so sorry that forced you to have to come out. I mean, that's the pressure, the kind of like lack of care with which people deal with things like sexuality, which by forces external to us are seen as like something so important that it just has to be hidden or whatever, to then be the same vehicle that sort of pushes you to disclose it is just really fucked up, I guess.
Yeah, exactly that. There's not even much more to say on that. It was just quite fucked up, and it's not something that I like to, you know, think about too much, because I mean, in a weird way, it also kind of is responsible for why I'm a writer now, because, you know, I wrote that Guardian piece, and it was like my first piece in the major newspaper, and I remember, really weirdly, the reason why I had written it was because I was like, look, all of this shit is out about me. I'm going to be applying for jobs because I was about to go to my final year of university. And I was really worried that any job I applied for was just going to Google me and like see all of these articles about me. So I was like, I need to write something so that even if they do Google me, they at least see this and at least see me kind of speaking for myself. And, you know, hopefully they have some sympathy. So that's the only reason why I wrote it. And then I just got a really lovely response. People were just like, this is amazing. This is really well written. You were really good. Have you thought about a career, you know, writing? And I thought, well, no, I only wrote this to literally just save my ass a bit. And I had done some writing at university, but I'd only done it in like the capacity of my like university positions or if there was a particular topic that I wanted to weigh in on. I hadn't thought about it as a career, but yeah, weirdly, it then kind of set me on that path, and it got my foot in the door at The Guardian as well. And I eventually started, you know, writing bits and bits until it developed into an entire career. So yeah, as much as it was an awful experience, it also kind of launched something different for me. So I wouldn't, it's not that I'm glad it happened or anything like that, but I guess everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, and sometimes from the most awful things, it can kind of jar you into doing a certain thing which turns positive. But yeah, as you say, it doesn't mean that it sort of negates what happened before. What was your intention then before you were going to become a writer? What were you intending on doing, or you weren't sure?
Strangely, I always wanted to be a teacher. I always wanted to be an English teacher. But I remember thinking I'm way too messy to be an English teacher, and I have like too much mess on my social media in public too. So I kind of just abandoned those dreams. But when I was in sixth form, I had an illegal job. Not illegal because it was illegal, but as in my sixth form didn't actually let us have jobs. But I used to sneak out during like free periods or like whenever after school to go and work, and it was at a tuition center called Explore Learning, where you would teach kids maths, English, verbal reasoning, you know, different skills. And I actually really enjoyed it. And I really thought that I'd actually really love to like teach classes one day. And I've not ruled out the idea of doing it in the future, either, you know, secondary school teaching or university teaching. But yeah, that's something I'd always wanted to do. But I think that I've also heard from, you know, some people who have become or trained to be teachers that there's a kind of conflict between them having certain ideologies or opinions and becoming teachers, and that it's like they're kind of vetted to make sure that they don't have views which are seen as anti-British or anything like that. And, you know, certain views are taken as anti-British even if they aren't necessarily anti-British. And even if they are anti-British, you know, people are anti-British for specific reasons to do with, you know, imperialism and racism and, you know, everything that's fucking going on at the moment. So yeah, it kind of was ruled out for me. And then I just ended up taking a really dry, boring job in policy for 2 years because that was a job I got and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. So, yeah, that's what ended up happening there.
That's so interesting. I mean, I said the same thing, but I wanted to be a teacher because I had the most incredible English teacher when I was in sixth form. And he was called Mr. Brown and he wore a brown suit and a brown tie and he's from Glasgow. And if you weren't if you weren't really concentrating, his voice was so monotone, he didn't really see anything at all. But I loved him. So I used to listen really intently. And he's telling us most amazing stories about like psychology and philosophy, like teach you about James Joyce through telling you about like just he was just the most interesting man. And it, like I like was so in love with him in every kind of sense, in that like I just was in awe of this like intelligence and this knowledge of the world. And I don't think since then there have been many people. I've spoken to so many incredible people on this podcast, but I think that when you're at that impressionable age, if you have a good teacher, you will never ever forget them. There is something about those people that, and so I then, maybe that's an ego thing actually, maybe I wanted to be like make someone feel like that. But after that I kind of had the same thing in the back of my mind where I'm like, maybe when I'm 50, like if I retire away from doing what I'm doing now, maybe then I'll go and be a teacher, because I do think there is something really special about it. And I think like especially people who love English teachers, that there's such a specific group of people who want to be English teachers. Do you know what I mean? It's such a type.
Well, it's interesting that I wanted to be an English teacher, because actually I think that the teachers who I had the best relationship and who were kind of like most formative with me were actually my history teachers. And it's interesting that I never studied history at university, because I think that the kind of work I do is very associated with like a particular kind of history, but I also don't think it's the kind of history that they're doing in the academy. So, I mean, it does make sense. But yeah, I remember we used to do like, you know, Russian history and British parliamentary history and international relations, looking at like the outbreak of the First World War and things like that, and Weimar Germany. And I found it, to be honest, I did enjoy a lot of it, except for British parliamentary history was surprisingly, shockingly bad. But I enjoyed a lot of it. My teachers used to make me feel really enthusiastic. Actually, recently, one of my history teachers passed away from cancer. I think it was cancer of the tongue or something like that. And it was actually really sad because, and being totally honest, I didn't love school and I didn't love everyone there. And not to say if some of those teachers passed away, I wouldn't care, but it's more that I wouldn't have necessarily stopped and be like, oh, that's actually, you know, a really sad loss for that school. Because, you know, I never returned to that school and I don't really think about it and I don't really engage with any of its alumni stuff. But I was really quite heartbroken that he had passed away, because actually he, in some ways, had been very formative for me thinking about, you know, history. And I nearly applied for it at university because I had better history teachers than I did anything else. I mean, in the end, I ended up studying sociology anyway. But yeah, that was a really tragic moment. And I was really grateful to him, because he just, I think that those history teachers really taught me how to write as well, and how to incorporate, and really how to argue too. I think that more than anything, they taught me how to really argue, make a case for something. And I think that a lot of my kind of article writing takes on this kind of like strong argumentative tone. And I think actually that comes from history more than any other subject.
That's so interesting. And yeah, and learning to debate. I remember us even having like debating class and things, but I'm really sorry for your loss. It is, sometimes those things do really kind of like take the wind out of you when you don't even know that you're sort of like holding space for that person, because you might not have thought about him for however long.
I hadn't, to be honest. I really hadn't. I remember just like my best friend just like messaged me from school, messaged me being like, Keith has died. And I was like, no, like this is awful. We didn't even know he was ill. So I guess, you know, he was keeping it private. But yeah, it was terribly sad news. It was a real loss.
I mean, thinking about this like social history kind of idea, I bet if you interviewed like every teacher, that would be just like the most incredible kind of like walk through what the world has been like, because they, I guess, see everything and are witness to sort of especially the most formative years of young people.
Well, I'd love to interview every teacher about me and every teacher who, you know, taught me at a certain age, because I don't know about you, but I always have this weird kind of amnesia about my teenage years. I think it's because I intentionally tried to forget about them because I just didn't love them. But I'd almost like to know, like, what was I like at that age? And, you know, what memories do you have of me, if you have any strong memories at all? Because you can be surprised what memories people hold on to of you, actually.
Yeah, and I think, I guess it's different for everyone, but especially for me as a teenager, I think I really didn't know myself. And so I was like play acting and trying on so many different hats. And like, I always wanted to be the class clown, and then I wanted to be like the clever one. And so it'd be interesting, because I'm sure that like adults are so much more perceptive than children in certain ways. I'm sure they would have been able to see through to who I probably was at that age. Whereas looking back in my own mind, I actually, I agree with you. I don't really know what people would have thought. Probably that I was a pain in the ass.
Yeah, and I also wonder what they think, if they think anything at all of what I'm doing now as well, if they expected that from me. Because in some ways, not to, this is going to sound really arrogant, but in some ways I've almost become like the star out of people from my year group from that school. I guess, you know, social media following and things like that. But I mean, I don't know anyone else who's writing a book. I mean, there's some people from my school who went on to be like really professional hockey players and have kind of like achieved like profile in that sense. But yeah, it's strange. Like, I'm an alumni of that school and I'm writing a book. And I guess like, you know, being honest, that's like quite a significant thing. And hopefully it's a success when it comes out. And I'd be like an alumni of that school. And I don't know, I'm not expecting them to like recognize me. And I don't really care that they do or anything like that. But yeah, I just wonder if anyone would see it and what they would think, basically.
And does it make you feel, how do you feel with that knowledge? Sort of like, do you feel proud or does it make you feel uncomfortable? Like, do you want, I'm sure that people will have seen your writing. It's sort of like inescapable that someone hasn't come across it, but it's always nice if someone acknowledges it.
In some ways uncomfortable, actually, weirdly. I don't know, if I saw one of my school teachers now, I think I would cross the road because I didn't want to have that conversation. I think that some of my writing, it's not necessarily exposing for me, but it's like I write about, you know, sexuality and being a black gay man in Britain and things like that. And at school, I didn't come out. I always say like, I wish I could turn back this clock and just come out in school. But I mean, I didn't, because like both my brothers were there. And if I was to come out in school, it would get back to them and then get back to my family. So that's the reason why I didn't. Otherwise, I just would have, because it was like obvious enough. But I remember there was actually a teacher who I was really sure, it was my history teacher, also the kind of deputy head of sixth form, or head of sixth form, one of them. I was really certain she was a lesbian, like very, very certain. And I remember that there was an incident in school where there was like, I can't remember exactly what happened, but there was a really bad homophobic incident in school. And I remember chatting with this teacher about how, you know, oh, it might be nice to like put up some posters, you know, about some like Stonewall posters saying like some people are gay, get over it, and having that conversation. I remember being so close to telling her, "Miss, I'm gay." I was really close, but I just didn't. I don't know why. I literally just didn't have the confidence to. I just didn't. And it wasn't that I wasn't confident in myself, because like outside of that, I'd already been dating boys outside, and like some people like outside of that environment already knew that I was gay and everything. I was like totally comfortable with it in myself, but I just didn't want to tell her, even though I knew she was gay as well. I knew she was. And it's strange. Yeah, I wonder if I was to ever see her again, I'd wonder if she ever remembered that conversation. Because in a way, I think she knew what I was trying to tell her. And I think she could tell, but she wasn't going to like egg me on or like, you know, make me tell her anything like that, which is, you know, obviously her being professional and considerate and not putting any pressure on me. But yeah, I wonder what it's like now to kind of see that this person who, you know, didn't really have the confidence to come out to you then is now actually writing about these things in quite like public places and is like very clear and strong on it.
So I'm going to go on to a second thing, because actually it ties in quite well. It's media and media ethics, and I want to know what you mean by this, and whether it's because you're obviously now in the media very, very vocally, as you just said. You have got quite a big platform. I read a lot of what you write. I just said before, I didn't realize how much of your articles actually read. Sometimes I don't even, that's bad, isn't it? I need to read who writes them. I'm just reading stuff. Lots of it's you. So yeah, tell me what you meant by that and what you wish you'd learned.
Yeah, I think I wish I'd learned more about how the media operates exactly and how it influences people too, because I think that I never got a good, strong sense of that until I started doing my own thinking about it when I was at university. And, you know, outside of university, as someone who works in the media as well, because even something like the BBC, understanding the BBC as like a politically contested site, I think is actually quite essential to anyone's education. It's important to know that, for example, at the moment, there are lots of different right-wing agendas about what the future of the BBC looks like. I mean, Places like the Adam Smith Institute want the BBC to be a subscription service, but the Conservatives want the BBC to kind of like be disciplined into wielding their own agendas for cultural hegemony. But I think that when I was a child, I mean, I didn't see media as completely neutral. I knew there were right-wing papers and I knew there were, you know, left-leaning or liberal-leaning papers. I knew that. I wasn't that stupid. But I didn't get the sense of just how much the media controls and shapes the political landscape and how indebted these two forces are to each other. Even, you know, recently with the whole, like, Meghan and Harry Oprah interview, and what was discussed, I think what was actually most important that was discussed there was the fact that, you know, journalists are invited to dinner at Buckingham Palace and the events are thrown at them to keep them amicable. And I kind of think that what is probably most likely holding us back from any kind of like Republican revolution or real discontent with the royal family is the fact that the media is keeping in line because they are well-fed, they are well paid off, and they are, you know, gifted with all sorts of luxurious things to keep the public on side. And it means that we don't live in a democracy. I think once people, you know, start to understand the disproportionate power and influence that the media wields, we realise that we do not live in a democracy. We do not live in the age of free, neutral, unbiased information. And we are, consent is constantly being manufactured by these papers. And I think that I remember when we would... in my history lessons, actually, something that we would do, sometimes we would have sources in the sources paper, and we would sometimes say have like newspaper sources, and we might say, you know, oh, this newspaper might be biased because it's right wing or whatever, but we wouldn't really dig into, you know, the problems of like ownership of certain papers and, you know, mass commercial ownership of papers, and just how much this is, you know, shaping opinion and ideology. And yeah, I think that, and also even media conduct as well, because I think that's something that really passed me by education-wise. So obviously this happened when I was in primary school, the kind of, you know, like the whole like News of the World scandal where they were like hacking phones and things like that. I mean, I was a primary school student then and I don't really expect to be taught that in primary school.
Yeah.
But I feel like that should have inspired, you know, more integrated curriculums looking at media conduct and media ethics. And I think that's a lack of like media education. I mean, if I could go back and do my A-levels again, I mean, my school didn't offer this, but I would have done A-level media. I think that would have been really important and really helpful to not just my career, but also understanding the politics of it and the ways in which, you know, journalists conduct themselves and actually being able to interrogate that and looking at, you know, what ethical journalism is and isn't. Because, you know, when I had my issues with the press, they turned up on my doorstep. It was really awful. And this was probably the worst part of it was totally behind the scenes. Rather than the, you know, articles which are kind of there for life, it was actually the fact that, you know, they were turned up to my doorstep and were kind of trying to harass my mother. And my mother was like freshly grieving my dad. And it was just like such a horrific intrusion. And it just made me think that no one actually warns you or educates you on just the way that the media conducts itself. Sometimes you find out the hard way. And I then think about, you know, every time I see like an article of, you know, people being exposed or doxed in the media, even if it's someone that I really disagree with or someone who, you know, you might think is justified in being gone after, I still think that so many people are kind of just under the crushing boot of these like media influences. And it's not just newspapers as well, it also extends into social media, and it then like overlaps with different institutions too. So something I've been thinking a lot recently is mugshots, mugshots of people who are wanted or have been arrested for certain crimes. And I just always think, like, why is it necessary for us to see mugshots of these people? Mm. Now, there was a recent kind of social media storm around Cold Harbour Police Station in Brixton, because on their social media, there were just lots of different mugshots of black men, entirely black men, lots of them quite clearly struggling with mental health issues. And the reason why it kind of like exploded on the internet was because they published a mugshot of a black man who looked very clearly distressed, and his offence was that he had been begging after he had been cautioned. And the way in which it was presented was basically to kind of be like, you know, we're keeping the streets safe and keeping this person off. And it's like, which communities are the police keeping safe? You know, it's one question, and I obviously have thoughts on that, but it was also like, what is the purpose for reproducing these images in a form of media? It's to intimidate, and it's also to kind of define, you know, what we consider this a citizen who is worthy, and a citizen who is, you know, worthy of protection and is worthy of being integrated into nation, and to show us very visually who the undesirables are. And obviously that happens, you know, on the social media accounts of these police officers, but it also happens in papers as well. And that's why, like, increasingly I've moved towards like a view that mugshots should not be included in newspapers or on social media sites, because it's entirely unnecessary. I don't need to see the face of this person you've arrested, because what purpose does it serve, particularly when the faces are disproportionately that of Black people, of people who are disabled, of people who come from certain class backgrounds and will have those particular class signifiers on their bodies. So yeah, I really wish that we had a more robust education of this, because I think that everyone needs to be more alert to media ethics. And, you know, the influence of media is only growing, not just because of, you know, newspapers, but also because of social media. And I think that, you know, we weren't properly braced for social media as well, and kind of social media conduct and social media ethics. I mean, the only thing that I remember being educated on in terms of social media in school was cyberbullying. And to be fair, I think that was necessary, because, you know, like, people are trolling and people are, you know, sharing horrible images of other people as well. But that kind of put the onus on just, you know, individual social media users and their conduct, but it didn't look at the ways that institutions can use social media or other kind of forms of information communication to really bully, to manipulate, to characterize villains of the public. And yeah, I just think that's really missing. That's really lacking.
I think you're so right. It's such a crucial education, which also, we, like you said, we couldn't have foreseen how much we would need to be able to arm ourselves with this understanding of how manipulated these stories and information are, and how manipulated we are as readers as well into believing, like you said, certain narratives. And you said something like, oh, I wasn't that stupid, I knew X, Y, Z. But I think, as you said, like, we didn't understand, we were taught these really obvious biases. You know, you have this paper which is left-leaning and this one leans to the right, and they might have these implicit biases or whatever. But even on a really, this is such a baseline level, but when I first started, but when I first became an influencer, I got flown on a trip abroad, and it was with lots of other journalists. And one of the journalists works for quite a famous women's magazine. And she was talking about how, oh, it's so annoying now because you have to declare gifts. Because years ago, what would happen is, you know, the beauty brands would just send over like a Chanel bag to your desk and say, happy Christmas, so-and-so. And basically that would mean we need to be number one on your, like, the best moisturizers to use or whatever. I remember sitting there and thinking, what? Because I would obviously, as a young girl, like, read magazines, and I would take those lists as gospel. Now, I know this is so much more like frivolous than what you're talking about, but even that just really shocked me. And the fact that also it's like, everyone knows, everyone who works in media knows that it's all bullshit. We know these lists are made up. It's trade-offs, it's gifting, as you say, which is interesting because in the influencer world, gifting has come under such scrutiny, but that's been happening with journalists, media, and things for years and years and years. And you were saying about people being outed, like, I guess more recently, like Philip Schofield. Like, now that I'm more in this industry, you do hear stories of people like, oh, it's because so-and-so had this, and so, you know, they did a deal with him and they said, you know, he's got to take the front page. And you just think how unethical, how like unhumane, and how have we got to this point where we agree to this? Like, I'm saying we as well, like, as being part of someone who's technically in the media, I'm sure maybe I've subconsciously sort of agreed to, I mean, I definitely do it with advertising on some sort of level, but I mean, with these more insidious things, well, how have we created this group of people that sort of are happy to take these bribes? I mean, I don't know. It's a weird thing when you dig into it. We talk about the media as sort of like a mass thing, but it's a machine of people. It's not, you know, AI.
No, but I think that's very true. And I think that we need to be clear about just how extensive lobbying is. I mean, I remember when Zara Sultana, the Labour MP for Coventry South, I think it is, first was elected to Parliament, she kind of actually was showing on her social media, like, the extent of lobbying in this country. Like, she was being sent, like, hampers from Heathrow, which, you know, obviously it's all MPs. And I just remember thinking, why has no MP ever, you know, just taken a picture and shown the extent to which, you know, MPs are receiving this every day? And also, something that I found really funny was, like, you know, these British politicians are being bribed by, like, a tin of biscuits and, like, a teddy bear. Whereas, like, in the US, they are bribed with, like, hard cash and, like, actual, like, luxury things. But even, I mean, I'm not gonna, like, shit on PRs or anything, but, like, even as a journalist, sometimes you get, like, in your inbox being messages being like, are you working on, like, a gift list, you know, would you be interested in putting this product on this? So I don't read lists anymore, because I know it's just PRs or whatever company has, you know, influence and tried to put itself in the top spot for this, and you can't really trust the recommendations on there. I mean, I'm kind of inhabit a weird space in that, you know, I'm obviously work as a writer, but I also have, like, a social media platform as well, and I talk about, like, TV and film and some of my writing. So sometimes I get gifted things, like not many. I mean, the things that I mostly get gifted are books, which I quite like because they help fill up my bookshelves and I like reading them. But sometimes I get gifted, you know, those kind of like hampers. So sometimes it might be Amazon Studios or MTV, and they will just be full of like little goodies. And it's mostly innocent because it's like, it's usually just to do some promotion for a show. But it also means like, if I accept this, you know, gift box from Amazon Studios in promotion of whatever show, does that mean like I also now have to kind of like mute my criticism of their like working conditions and, you know, the fact that you have like Amazon drivers having to like piss in bottles if they have time to do that at all. It's difficult. I think that it's about the kind of like brand and reputation management and how happy you are to kind of be part of it. I mean, sometimes you can just accept the gifts, and I personally don't think it's necessarily a huge deal on an individual level to accept the gifts if you're not in the realm of politician. Sometimes you're just an influencer, or you're someone on social media, and that's not necessarily to like minimize the influence of that, but it's not this. I don't think there's any point in pretending it's the same as like political corruption. And I think sometimes like influencers can sometimes be held to that standard, and it's like, we don't have to act like these are all the same. Chill, you know. And so, yeah, I feel strange about gifting. And the kind of benevolence that's expected then towards a certain company or brand. I mean, I remember I was recently like gifted the book, and I tweeted something, I posted it on my story, but I was like, you know, I have a criticism of this book and I'm going to say it. And I said it, and the person just replied saying, oh, thank you. But I remember acknowledging like she shared every other like person posting the book on her story, but she didn't share mine, I guess, because it had a criticism, which is fair. If you don't want to share something that says something negative, that's totally fine. But it just shows how much it's about like, I'll gift this to you and you say something really nice about it so your followers can buy it. But I might not feel like that, even if it's been sent to me.
Totally. And I think it's so interesting because obviously I'm an influencer. I do actually get gifted. I mean, I've asked to be gifted less purely from like a waste point of view, because I used to get sent so much crap and I literally, this is wasteful. But I do still get sent things, yeah. And you're not obliged to post it. So I often don't post. So I really only post, I love getting food and alcohol, which is bad, but I do because it's just, you can't really say no to a free food. But there is, there's kind of this implicit understanding that you, if you're accepting this gift and you're going to share it, you kind of can't say badly about it, which is obviously a complete false economy, and it's really not helpful. And it's exactly what we were talking about with the lists in the magazine thing. But the irony, sorry, we're probably going off topic, but the irony of the influencer thing is I find that people are much, but like you said, I remember that MP sharing that hamper and I remember being absolutely aghast. But because it's always sort of been a part of influencer culture to get gifting, the lay public are now aware of that as a concept and have, as you said, like a very low threshold for kind of letting influencers do things, which is great. We have the ASA, like people are really strict about things, but it's just fascinating that it took like, as you say, something which has much less sway in terms of like, it's not political, I'm not a politician, but they're held to a much higher standard than sort of people are who literally work in the House of Commons. And I found that really, there's almost like a public, what's the right word? Like a dissonance of understanding between when we're closer to something where we find it easier to critique, whereas there's so much like distance between, I guess, us and politicians that people almost don't have the energy to sort of, not everyone, but I think general public are just like, oh, well, they're corrupt anyway. Do you know what I mean?
I totally agree with that. And I think it's that, but I also think there's like an extent of misogyny as well. And there's this idea that, you know, influencing is easy and that it's not real work. And, you know, therefore, you know, it's open to significant criticism. So I remember, I think a good point is like, you know, during the pandemic, you know, influencers who were jetting off to Dubai were kind of like named and shamed on social media and kind of like held up as like, you know, what's going wrong with our society and like the peak of selfishness and things like that. And I just kind of remember thinking like, look, It's annoying to be sat in your house, you know, during the pandemic and seeing people jet off to these different locations because they're wealthy enough to do so. But also what's driving this pandemic and what's, you know, kept these numbers so high is the fact that we had meatpacking factories still open and workers are forced to work in certain conditions. And, you know, we had a government which was, you know, happy to let bodies power high. to save the economy, which was not even saved. So I often think that sometimes there's a kind of deflection in the strategy. And it's not to say that, you know, people can't criticize, because people are allowed to criticize, you know, any industry. And I kind of think that if you take on the role which is public facing, then you are kind of open to scrutiny, obviously, you know, within certain limits. I think that that doesn't mean that you're open to abuse, but you will be open to challenge or interrogation and have to kind of answer for yourself. But I just thought, like, is this like Love Island star going on holiday the thing that people need to be riled up about? No. It's annoying, sure, but it's not the peak of, it's not everything that's wrong with the United Kingdom, you know?
No, but I guess it marries everything that we're obsessed with, which is just like kind of that reality star drama mixed with politics. It's literally like a telenovela playing out. Like, it's like we've lost all sense of, as you say, like a scale and understanding of, like, it's definitely annoying. Yeah. I definitely think, obviously, don't break COVID rules and fly to Dubai. That's just, why would you do that? But as you say, like, it's the drama of it all. It's like everything suddenly just become like we're living in a sitcom. It's not, there's no real kind of, which is what is, I find interesting, because when I log onto Twitter, and obviously you're a very good tweeter, avid tweeter, and you're often like doing like taking the holding people to account, you're discussing this really importantly. And sometimes I look at my Twitter feed, which is actually mostly young journalists in their 20s, to be honest, and it's got way more to say for itself, like that feed and that stream of consciousness and all those opinions, than any of the papers, if I picked up any of those papers on a given day. And it's just fascinating how, like, there's definitely, obviously, we need to buy real papers and this whole thing about, you know, it's a dying industry, but kind of, if you're, when you do have these stories that are kind of just nothingness, it's no wonder that we've just got a whole generation that just looks to, you know, social media for the news rather than tabloids and traditional print.
I mean, media's newspapers are curated in the way that, like, your social media timeline is not. I mean, my Twitter is literally just me going off on my thoughts about something with kind of no filter. And obviously, like, a certain paper has to set a certain agenda. It has to say things with certain lines. It can't be seen as contradicting itself. It needs to, I mean, I think that, you know, contradictions are beautiful. I contradict myself all the time because thoughts are complex and no one has entirely consistent thoughts. And I think this idea that, you know, we need to be absolutely consistent in everything is unrealistic, because that's not how people think. But, you know, a newspaper has to hold a certain line, or if they abandon a certain line, they've got to have a really roundabout reason for abandoning it. I mean, today's the day of the, you know, the local elections and all of these different papers, which had, you know, been praising Keir Starmer for his forensicness and all of that, are now kind of changing their tune, but they're doing it in such a way that they're not making concessions to the fact that certain people had these criticisms of him in the first place. They're just diagnosing new issues and kind of saying, you know, oh, well, he was good for, basically, you know, people went from saying, you know, this is someone who's going to save Labour and bring in a new era, to then saying, yeah, he was always meant to be good for the transition, but now it's time for someone else. And it doesn't so much contradict what they were saying before, and it still holds a certain line, but it also completely ignores the fact that the issues that are now blowing up with Keir Starmer were predicted by people who don't ideologically align with what these papers and what these columnists have been saying. So, yeah, you can never really, if you just, I wonder what it's like for people who just read newspapers to shape their opinions, and what, or even what my outlook would be if I just looked at newspapers to shape my opinions. I think that social media is kind of a force for good in some ways. I mean, obviously everyone's timeline is an echo chamber, and it depends on what you select and the size of you. But yeah, it allows me to actually, like, properly engage and properly think through things. Whereas I think that newspapers proclaim to have done the thinking for you, I guess, is the significant difference. Whereas, you know, Twitter timelines are snippets of information and, like, different people's thoughts, and you kind of construct them and interpret them and form your own conclusions.
I think you put that perfectly. And also, I watched that critical thinking, like, play out. I've seen it with you, where you've, like, disagreed with someone else that I know that you, like, have really similar beliefs to, and then I'll read both things and I'll think, oh, that's interesting, I hadn't really thought about it like that. And it gives me the space then to think, oh, I wonder what I think. Whereas I agree, like, my mum reads papers cover to cover, and I bet that she walks away and she's like, as you said, the thinking's done for her, she's done great, that's what I need to know about the day, fantastic, I'll store that and I'll remember that for next time. Whereas I think this is more exclusive to Twitter than other platforms. There is a lot of that working out that you get to be a part of, not always, also because of, obviously everyone then has this fear also of changing their mind. You have the one school of thought where the working out, and, you know, you're doing the critical thinking, and the other side is, once you've made your bed, you've got to line it, and you cannot possibly suddenly go from liking Keir Starmer to disliking Keir Starmer, because people will be like, but you liked him yesterday, or whatever. That's a really damaging part of social media. But I think it is, because I follow lots of journalists who are my age, your age, who are changing the form a bit of what it means to be someone in the media. Do you think that's true, or does it come up as a problem if you don't want to write in a certain way? Has it been an issue for you, or do you think the landscape of media is just going to have to change to fit around this new? It's not really new, but a different way of doing things.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think that's true, but I also think the kind of like young journalist class that I belong to are people who aren't staff writers, who are freelancers. And the reason why we are freelancers is because there's such a dearth of opportunities. Like, I don't expect to get a staff job. It's just too impossible. And because these jobs are now so scarce, people are moving around less. Like, some of the editors that I was working with years ago are in the same position at the same paper still now, because move and go where, you know?
Yeah.
So because a lot more of us are kind of just, you know, working for ourselves, and there's a real decline in like local journalism opportunities and being like trained in-house, it kind of means that, you know, we're training ourselves and we're becoming alert ourselves, and that makes us inherently critical of media and the way media is done. And so it means that we kind of set our own rules, and we also have to stand out by having set our own rules and by having, you know, writing and speaking by the rules that we set rather than the rules that are set by, you know, mainstream media. And I think, just going back to what you were saying before about, you know, how much, you know, these like different spaces can influence you to change your mind. I mean, one of my really good friends actually told me this morning that his mum had been like a ferocious Keir Starmer defender because she had been reading Guardian columns that were in favour of him. But Marina Hyde came up with a column basically saying that he's useless. And his mum has now been like, I agree with that. Yeah, Keir Starmer, useless. So almost as if overnight, because she's been following the Guardian line, you know, a selection of Guardian journalists, her view has just been shaped. And as much as I'm not a fan of Keir Starmer, I wasn't infused by that. I didn't think, oh, great, now she's seen the light. I thought, look how easily people can just be, views can just be shaped by just a columnist's opinion rather than them actually doing any kind of independent thinking. And the implications that has for like everything else beyond Keir Starmer, beyond like the Labour Party and our views of other things, is just alarming.
But I think also there's like people are a bit reticent to going at, like, what it's, first of all, it is hard for people to kind of take a decision which goes against, you know, the status quo. So if your friends are all Guardian readers and that's all you've ever read, even if deep down you're somewhere like starting to question it, it can be terrifying to kind of take that leap and look for something that's on the opposing line. But I now come to things basically saying I have no fucking clue, because that's happened to me so many times where I think I formed an opinion and then I read a piece and I think, oh no, I agree with that. And then I think it is really scary to think, God, I obviously don't know what I'm talking about at all. Then if I can change my mind that easily on something, then I think, right, there's obviously, I need to learn about this a lot more. And I wanted to go back quickly actually to what you were saying about, I just was thinking about how many times it's funny watching the generational difference between like your generation of writers and the older ones who seem constantly threatened by what you guys are writing and saying on Twitter. Because you all do kind of have your own voice, and you're also not worried about saying things, and you don't sort of act in a way that's like traditional media, kind of like bum licking up to whoever is the current flavor of the week. Do you enjoy that kind of conflict, or do you find it a bit like stressful, or it doesn't bother you?
I mean, I kind of like the conflict, because I think that, you know, they do feel threatened, and they do know that, you know, we are often more talented and better thinkers than them. That, you know, people are increasingly turning to looking at, you know, younger journalists and what they have to say about certain things, because they realise that actually they're giving them fresh, independent insights and not just following the line of the paper, or they're not just being lobbied by some politicians who write things in a certain way, or we're not just, you know, consolidating class interests or whatever in papers. But I also think that it does also lead to some abuse. I mean, I've gotten some abuse from politicians even and like senior journalists for articles that I've written in like Tribune. So I remember I wrote an article looking at the context of Blairism and reality TV in the early 2000s, and I was looking at how the kind of social policy landscape of Blairism kind of influenced the media landscape in terms of television shows and what was considered entertaining and who was considered degenerate. And it was quite a straightforward argument, and it was really, you know, I made sure it was backed up because it was a bold argument to make by, you know, things that were actually happening. So like, for example, the UN in, I think, 2008 had directly condemned the Labour government, saying that its policies were leading to children being exploited in reality television shows like Super Nanny or whatever. And I just had some of these like centrist politicians and journalists being like, oh, you know, this just abuse, being like, how did this person get his degree, you know, this person. It's never actually about the argument. Also, it's never anything, there's never a response to any of the points that you make. It's just abuse about you and a kind of character assassination, and being like, oh, this person's just like really left radical. And some of it also gets quite racist a lot of the time. But I think an example of that is, you know, my friend Moya, she wrote an article for The Guardian. She's the Galden political editor, and she's my housemate as well, and she wrote an article for The Guardian about Keir Starmer, basically saying like he kind of stands for nothing. And a bunch of really awful journalists, politicians, whoever they were, basically started saying like, oh, as if we can take her seriously because she'd written some pieces for like Stylist magazine. And it was just an ignorance of the fact that, you know, if you are like a young journalist, you end up writing about really disparate topics, and you can write a serious political article, and you can also write something that, you know, someone might consider more fluffy, and that's fine. You know, like, I'm going to be writing articles about Love Island this summer when it's on. That doesn't mean I don't have serious political analysis. It just means I live a rounded life like lots of other young people, and that doesn't make me really unique. It's not like, oh, I can do both. It's like most of us do both. Lots of us, you know, have really rounded lives. But yeah, there's a kind of like abuse, and there's so much like, there is so much derogatory treatment towards, you know, young journalists who are independent minded. I think some of it's jealousy and projection, being honest, because, you know, I guess they wish they could be us. But most of all, it can be very unpleasant. And I think that it can also be quite demotivating as well, because sometimes, you know, these people might hold influence at a big publication. I mean, luckily, the kind of publications that I work at tend to either be so big that it wouldn't matter if one editor didn't like you. So say, for example, The Guardian is big enough that if some editor or some columnist doesn't like me, it doesn't matter. Like, one thing I've always said about The Guardian is that no matter how many times I criticize it publicly, they still let me write for them. So it's fine. Or, you know, we tend to write for magazines where the people who are editors are like close to us in age and also tend to have similar views as well. So like, I mean, I've got an editor who I work with on my close friend's Instagram story. So sometimes it can be that close. So yeah, the kind of like difference generations, it is quite stark, and sometimes the relationship there can be very not nice, I think.
That's interesting. I actually remember reading that piece that you wrote about Blairite and like TV, because I remember thinking as well about how much I'd realised that the C word, I don't think you should say it, but about like that kind of like class degradation and that time in my life. And I remember thinking, I've completely kind of forgotten about Asbos. And I think you spoke about, what was that show? You Are the weakest Link or whatever, in that piece, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I forgot that there was a massive chunk of my life that was completely dictated about this idea about like unruly lower class youths who were going to come and like smash up your garden or whatever. And I'd completely forgotten that had been like quite a big, like, okay thing that people would talk about, like when I was young. And I'd forgotten about that. And I was like, that it really kind of made me realize how it's funny, because you never really see those things anymore. And then I saw, I think maybe around the time that you'd written that piece, that people were bringing up again, You Are the Weakest Link, whatever. Is that what the show was called? Was it just called The Weakest Link?
It was Weakest Link.
Yeah, and just how, and all of those kind of programs, and like Benefit Street, and all the sort of like poverty porn, and like just really odd takes. And nothing to say apart from I remember thinking that article was interesting, and it just made me revisit a time in my life that I'd completely forgotten and just chalked up to like history. And then actually now, like, knowing what I know and living the way that we live and speaking the way that I speak and thinking about that being so normalized is really odd. So
And that leads into, you know, media ethics as well, right? Because, I mean, in those days, The Sun would be publishing, like, the names and faces of really young children who had been given ASBOs, or at least that was proposed by some, like, certain, like, new Labour cabinet ministers to do that. And, you know, there would always be, like, stories of, you know, different unruly youths and what they've got up to. And that kind of manufactured consent for, you know, the nation's children to be treated as kind of underclass. And so thinking about that relationship between media and politics is really, really incredibly important, because media just kind of helps set and build consent for the policy agenda which politicians want. And that matters. And I think that's something that you just don't become super aware of. Because I remember as a child, you know, I was growing up in a council estate, and I don't love going on about my background, but I remember just, like, there was always the talk about, you know, hooded youths and the C word and ASBOs. And I remember thinking sometimes, you know, is this me? Because I'm from this background, and, you know, myself and my friends and my brothers, I guess we fit the profile of who these politicians are talking about and what the media's talking about. And then obviously you'd see it on shows about, like, Super Nanny or Wife Swap or whatever, this idea of, you know, unruly children, and all sorts of other shows as well, and stuff about like fat families and things like that. And you just kind of ended up internalizing some of these ideas of you as a kind of, like, inferior species within the nation. And yeah, it just matters to think that it's, yes, it's like the political agendas of the day, but also how complicit are all forms of media with establishing those ideas and making it people think that this kind of degradation is okay. Because, you know what, when people go back and watch those Weakest Link shows, they're just, like, shocked. They're absolutely shocked about that. They're like, that was on primetime television not very long ago, but at the time you would have watched it and not batted an eyelid. And I wanted people to think about, you know, how do you get to a point where you can get to this level of, you know, degradation, persecution of minorities, and it can just happen before your eyes and you're completely numb to it, you know, because at the time it would have gone past undetected.
It just was something that was just sort of like you were allowed to say it. Like, I think there was definitely the understanding that it was, like, it's obviously not nice, but it was like that. Yeah, it's exactly what you said. You're giving people permission to say, look, you're a nuisance or you're whatever. And it also completely emancipates the system, the state and the parents from, like, these, it's as if children, what, do they just exist in a vacuum and just pop up and then are just absolute, like, hellraisers, as if they've where have they got this? If they were naughty, like, where has that come from? Talking about media ethics, you tweeted something I was just trying to look for, but I can't remember. And I guess this is kind of like swinging through back the other day, the complete other way. And you were like, the one thing I worry about now is, like, what do people actually think my work's any good? Or are they literally just getting me on to talk to them or to write for them because I'm black and gay? And I guess that's in a really weird way, sort of like a full pendulum swing to the other side, where it's still unethical, but it cleverly kind of masks itself as being ethical. Is that something that you're starting to question more?
Yeah, I question that, because sometimes maybe this is just comes from me being critical. And I remember when I went and met my editor at Faber for the first time, we just went for, like, lunch together. And I remember saying that, you know, I get a bit worried sometimes that, you know, there are some sections which can be really obsequious to, like, different black writers or black gay writers, and kind of say, you know, oh, we love your work, this is amazing. But sometimes you don't know if they actually love it that much, or if they're overcompensating because they're like, oh, you know, you're young and you're black and you're gay, you're diverse, and therefore we need to be seen as supporting this. And sometimes it means that, you know, you're not sure of a proper quality assessment of the work that you're doing, either, you know, the kind of literary work that I'm doing, or even just, like, the articles that I put out. And yeah, it does make me question things, because sometimes I read things from black journalists and I think, this is not very good, or this is not very well researched, or this is not very well written, but it will be getting lots of praise. And hey, maybe people actually genuinely do think that they like it, but I also wonder, do people feel like they can't, like, constructively criticize an article because, you know, we need to be seen as, you know, supporting each other, or people want to be publicly seen as, you know, bigging up this, like, black writer or something. Yeah, there's kind of difficult tension there.
No, it is really interesting. I think the one thing that's also interesting is that years ago there would have been so many young white male, especially writers, who probably were shit, and people were like, oh, that's fine because your dad's so-and-so, and they never would have been, like, critically questioning that, like you are. Like, they would never have been like, oh my god, am I actually not that good? They'd be like, great, thank you, walk through the door. By the way, I do think you're a good writer. But I do agree but I think I think now, oh god, sorry, we're talking for ages, but like, I guess going into, like, some of the things that happened, I can't remember when it was, beginning of this year, with, like, online again in the same generation, people are being like, look, we can't just use identity politics as something to be like a tick box. We have to, like, keep each other in check and sort of not give free passes just because we're trying to change the narrative around things. So I wonder if that is going to, but then that's dangerous because then you don't want to tip the balance again where it like allows people to be outright racist or outright discriminatory or like prejudice, whatever. Like it, that's why it's scary to kind of call it, not that I would call it out, but like going into that critical sense, then I just think it's so that exactly as you said, there's such a tension there and it kind of can make or break a certain situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think it's easy for people to kind of, and I don't want to like name anyone's names or examples because that's just messy, but I think it's easy for people to kind of like bring up their identities as a way to kind of deflect criticism or to, you know, insist that people support them. I mean, I could easily kind of like demand that people support me because I'm a black gay journalist and I'm owed that or something, but I want people to support me because they like the work that I'm doing and that they learn something from it and that they think that I'm talented and they're invested in my growth and my career. But yeah, there's a kind of tension because you do want to be able to actually have that kind of like intra-community discussion and criticism and, you know, I hate the term hold people accountable because I often think like, why do I need to be accountable to a bunch of strangers, which I think is totally fair. But be able to say, you know, like this is, you know, a dangerous ideology, or to say like this is not an idea which we should stand for and we shouldn't just accept this, you know, uncritically because it's coming from someone who is from the same identity group as you. I mean, there can be, you know, conflicts and differences in how people think. I mean, I think something recently was that, say, for example, the kind of like visuals and activism which propped up in response to the very sad murder of Sarah Everard, there were actually divisions in terms of feminist responses to it. I mean, there was some division between what the organization that popped up called Reclaim These Streets was doing and the kind of money they were raising, where they were putting it, as compared to what Sisters Uncut were doing. And it's like, you can't, you know, say that there's one coherent woman's view on the kind of like organizing or the response that's needed to this kind of violence. We are all diverse in the kind of views that we have. I mean, not every black person, for example, believes in the abolition of the police like I do. Not every black person believes in ending deportations like I do. And so I think that we need to kind of stop using identity as the ground zero for our discussions and our analysis. And even particularly, I mean, I'm always cautious of this because sometimes I think, you know, like, oh, how much do I want a white person weighing into black issues or something like that? But sometimes I think, like, we don't necessarily need to preclude people from conversations because of their identity if they do have something valuable to say and if they do have something valuable to teach. I mean, I'm more likely to take directions from someone like, say, Owen Hatherley, who's like one of the white editors of Tribune, than I am from Kemi Badenoch, who's like a black conservative MP. So yeah, I think that I'm really glad that, you know, as I've gotten older, I've really let go of this idea that I need to like align with people of my ethnic group or my sexuality. I mean, I've seen like three different black gay Tories on Twitter who emphasize that they are black gay Tories because no one does identity politics like Tories, to be honest. And it's kind of like, I can't pretend that there's mutuality between our ideologies or any kind of ground just because we come from, you know, the same identity groups. It's just not the case. I mean, even in my household, we don't have the same ideological views. I mean, my younger brother and I are both like quite left-wing Labour. My mother's more centrist. My older brother, I think, is more centrist as well. So yeah, I'm pleased for there to be more kind of like inter-community criticism and dialogue, and I'm hoping that over time we start to see, you know, more articles, more writing that really interrogates black communities. I mean, something that I'm really interested in is interrogations of class amongst black people. I think that's kind of inspired my experiences at private school, because I came to private school and I was like on a scholarship and I was like from a poor background, and it was quite obvious that I was as much as I tried to hide it. And I remember like a lot of the time people asked me like, oh, it must have been really bad, like all those middle class white people. I'm kind of like, well, yes, but also some of the middle-class black people were also quite awful, and they held certain views. Like, they would be like really condescending about people who lived in council estates like I did, and I kind of thought, like, you know, there wasn't some kind of like racial solidarity or cohesion there. Like, people do have certain views which might be informed by class, and just because they're black doesn't mean that I can't criticize them or hold them to account. I hate that term, but yeah, doesn't mean I can't criticize them for that or be clear about the kind of like violences which can exist within groups. So yeah, I'm really just fed up of identity as the ground zero of every kind of criticism.
Yeah, me too. But I remember thinking, like, when I first was like becoming to understand about intersectional feminism, intersectionality and all this stuff when I was at uni, and I was like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. This is how we should be organizing each other and working it out on like a you get 5 points for this, minus 5 points for this, and we can work out these like privilege checklists, and then we can all sort of like, and yeah. as you say, it's just so much more complicated than that, and it's so redundant to just be like, okay, well, you can speak on this, because not that, far be it for me, I'm not saying I want to get involved in criticizing anyone for anything, but just starting again, it's just that critical eye. It's not even being critiquing, it's not necessarily saying someone's wrong, it's just having that ability to zoom out and think, actually, like, am I literally just listening to this person because they have, you know, this many followers and identify as XYZ and do this? Like, you know, there has to be sort of like an amalgamation of lots of things. I think is it Shardeen Taylor Stone is someone that I follow on Twitter, and she did a really good tweet quite a while ago about like why we've got to stop looking at identity politics and think about more like coalition building and kind of forget all of this idea of what separates us, because it's kind of just finding more ways to tear each other, like separate each other. It's kind of, I think we've done it. I think we've done identity politics like to the death.
Yeah, and I think that those ideas are really well explored in Emma DeBerry's What White People Can Do Next, which is a really fantastic book that I've like raved about. And she also talked about that need for coalition building and the fact that we just, I think sometimes I think when I was like 18 and I'd like discovered the concept of privilege, I was like, oh my God, yeah, this really understands it. This is a good organizing principle for understanding the world. And now I'm really sick of this idea that we all need to kind of like, this kind of confessional politics where everyone needs to like stack their different intersections and kind of like weigh up and see who's more marginalized than the other before deciding who can speak. Like, people need to actually, I think what was a good distinction that was made in the book was when Emma kind of said that, you know, people are getting information but they're not getting knowledge, and knowledge is made by like engaging and, you know, generating and criticizing and thinking through things properly rather than just like taking some things as authority. Like, I kind of got to the position where I'm like, no, I'm not going to take your authority on this purely because of who you are. I'm going to think about these things independently and read a wide range of things and come to my own conclusions, and that matters. Because I think that, you know, there were points where I probably believed or followed certain things because I thought, oh, this person's of this identity group, so I should follow what they're saying. But it's like, we don't all have the same opinions, we all have our own conflicts, so everyone has to do their own work, and that's what matters the most. And I often think the kind of like privilege beating, I think, you know, in some cases, like it still matters and it's still significant, and in certain environments it matters, but I kind of think that the whole white privilege stuff, sometimes it becomes a very corporate idea. Like, sometimes it's about, you know, who gets a promotion above you based on privilege, and that's, you know, those are valid discussions, but it's not the same as, you know, articulating the language of like class conflict and interests in coalitions and the kind of violences that people face, which aren't reducible to privilege, they're about power. And I think that it was Sean Fay, a friend of mine, who put that on her story, where she was basically like, you know, this idea of privilege, say like cis privilege, she was talking about, is really outdated because it's about power. And she was saying how, like, as a transgender woman, it was a cisgender doctor who, you know, operates her on her. It's like a cisgender civil servant or something who like processes her like gender recognition certificate, or I don't really know the technicalities of it. But it's understanding where different actors have power and how, you know, these things occur. I think that a lot of people are also starting to kind of like move past this like kind of like hyper identity politics, like privilege discussion. I mean, I remember back when, I think the time when I started to realize this is a bit ridiculous is when there were discussions basically being like how to explain white privilege to a homeless person. I just thought, this is ridiculous. I don't care about explaining white privilege to a homeless person. I would care about, you know, getting them off the streets and looking at what kind of like health needs that they have. So I sometimes think that we get bogged down in these discussions, and all it is it's just a discussion. That's it. It's just us talking, and white people or straight people or cisgender people just self-flagellating and apologizing for their privilege. And what is actually gained for anyone?
Yeah, that's the thing. This is where this podcast kind of ended up. It wasn't meant to be about this. And then it ended up being like, oh my God, let's find out about the world and all stuff. And then it ended up being sort of just, not awareness raised. I've had so many incredible conversations, but I got to the point where I was like, I don't need to, like, we don't need to raise awareness. I think there's a whole generation of people of loads of different ages who have this same sort of like awakening at the same time, and all find it, and then now are all, as you said, like fucking fatigued. Like, we don't, but the irony being that like mainstream publication, whatever, are just catching on. I really need to read Emma's book. I have it written down anyway, but it just sounds like it's a great next step in that conversation, because I think we have all done it to death, and it sort of makes you feel a bit like, oh my God, I'm going to vom if I have to read one more thing, even though I was definitely like such a big player in those conversations, which felt like relevant at the time. And now I look back to podcasts a few years ago and I'm like, oh my God, shut up. This is just like, what good does it do? I'm literally like listing my privilege. I did a TED talk and the beginning of the TED talk, I'm like, yeah. I'm white, cis, hat, able-bodied, neurotypical, like,
yeah.
As if that was somehow, then it was like, once I'd said all of that, it's like, okay, now I can speak. And it's like, actually,
yeah,
that's not really relevant, you know? It is, but it's not in that sense.
It's just that it's the politics of confession, and it just becomes really unnecessary. Yeah, it's writing yourself into, it's like setting yourself up to discuss something by first acknowledging the different ways in which you are privileged, but that doesn't necessarily, it also doesn't necessarily make any difference in what you're even saying. So I think my friend Rachel wrote a really good article about this, but I just can't quite remember the details of it. But I think it was for The Guardian, where she basically just writes about like how sometimes like authors kind of set up by talking about their different privileges, but it doesn't actually like bear on any kind of reflection of their actual positionality beyond talking about that privilege. I'm kind of like glad to see the end of that reductionism. I think it's good for people to kind of come full circle and realize that like this kind of like economy we have of, you know, privilege, raising awareness and privilege and all of that. I mean, I constantly go on about how much I hate infographics on Instagram because I'm always just like, you know, who is this for? And where it's kind of like, here's what you can do about this. And here are seven ways in which you are privileged above me. And I just think, who's this for? Because like, first of all, like most people in your timeline, unless you're education about a humanitarian crisis or something like that, most people in your timeline know what white privilege or whatever it is. And they've decided if they care or if they don't. Sometimes it's not about awareness raising. It's not the case that, you know, someone will become educated and now suddenly that they will, you know, start behaving or have a different worldview. People know these things. They've read the arguments and they've chosen their alignment. You know, giving Boris Johnson a book on white privilege is not going to change anything. So I think basically understanding that actually what we are facing is class struggle and class conflict. And that's what matters. And actually being clear that this is a battle which is based in aggression, is based on, you know, certain interests actually clashing with each other. And that's always how history has been, right? Rather than acting as if it's a process in which, you know, we can hold people's hands and we can win these things by, you know, being really, really loving and kind of like guiding people through it. That's not how these things are won, and it's never how these things have been won. And I think that it distracts from the necessary work that actually needs to happen and actually going up against. And I think that one of the most instructive and educational things that's been going on at the moment has been the Kill the Bill process. It's been educating people on the extent of state power and the extent of state authoritarianism and what the actual threats to speech are. And it's politicized and mobilized people who have not previously been politicized and mobilized and thought about their rights in terms of protest and thought about the ways in which government tries to suppress dissent. And that is so much more powerful and impactful than just flogging people about their privilege, because it shows that you do have a stake in anything that the state does. All of us have a stake in how the state operates. And all of us going out and building people power and protesting and shutting these things down is what's going to help, you know, break these things. And, you know, people refer to, you know, the massive backlash in response to the poll tax, which was what ended up undoing Thatcher in the early 90s. And it's like, we do need to be ready for these big conflicts, and the fact that the revolution isn't going to happen by Instagram infographic. Understanding that your position is not about confessing your different privileges and your intersections and then talking. It's about attending these protests if you can. It's about sharing the resources which are actually important and which matter, and also educating yourself and critically thinking. I always emphasize people need to critically think. When you're reading something, you need to read it to critically think with it. Pick up a pencil, engage. What do you agree with? What do you disagree with? Why do you think that as a result of reading that? It's important.
But as you said, I definitely think that it's literally, as you said, like coming full circle, and there's going to be this huge swathe of everyone suddenly going, oh fuck, what are we doing? Like, why are we sharing this infographic that like we've literally seen the last million people that we follow? I do that now where I'm like, I'm not fucking sharing it. You can send it to me, but like, I know that you've already seen it on 80 people's stories. So why do you want me to put it up? Because all that does is says, yeah, I've seen it. Don't worry, tick. And I might not read it. You don't even know if I've looked at it. I could have just shared it. And that's where I think it's now people are starting to go, oh, okay. I do think there was a point, like maybe in the height of last summer, when actually it was amazing. People were literally learning about, you know, white supremacy for the first time, whatever. And but then that kind of then got diluted and turned into like this thing that is now, there's an infographic for literally anything. And but
I remember not loving those infographics at the time. I get why it was useful and some people it was useful and that's fine, but I remember like recently on Instagram, sometimes people, I know that sometimes they don't even follow me, they will send me an infographic that they made and ask me to share it, and I will think, fuck off, why have you asked me to share this because you're trying to raise awareness? Or I think one thing people have realized is that if they create something that's really shareable, like an infographic, everyone shares it on their stories and it drives up their engagement rate and they gain followers, and it means that their selfie gets more likes. Kind of like a calculation like that, and that's why people share infographics, and it's quite obvious. And one really cynical thing that's happened recently, and I was really appalled by this, recently someone had posted something of like a young missing black person, and this account didn't even follow me, and it just sent it in my DMs to share it. And I noticed that it was like watermarked with their podcast. It was this image of a missing black child and it was watermarked with their podcast. And not only was the child already found and they kept the post up, but it was like, you send this to me randomly so I could share it. So what, you could get what, 30,000 likes because it's gone viral. And then you hope that what, 100 people will follow you and start following your podcast. I just thought that is sick. And I thought that this kind of like information sharing economy, it's so easily exploited. It's so easily exploited because also you feel guilty if you don't share that missing person or if you don't share that infographic talking about a certain crisis. But, and it's not, and I think that a lot of the time, you know, we feel disempowered and we feel like there are ways that we cannot help. I mean, today is a day where people feel particularly helpless and people are just like, you know what, it's going to be fucking Tory for the next 20 years, just fuck it, what can we do? And sometimes social media gives us a way to make us feel like we're doing something because it feels like it's an action, because you know people talk about words, not action. So sharing something feels like an action, or donating to something feels like an action, but a lot of the time it isn't. And sometimes I do think we need to also understand that, you know, sometimes these bigger issues are bigger than us as individuals, and that does not mean you have to be apathetic or start disengaging or anything like that, but it does mean that you need to think about things critically. You need to think about why you're sharing something and what the benefit of sharing it is. You need to educate yourself on the issues. If you're going to read an infographic and you care enough to share it, I hope that you're also reading further. You know, I hope you didn't just read the infographic and put it there and not read it further, because you know that's what people are doing. So yeah, I was really appalled by that person who sent me that picture of the missing child. I just deleted the DM because otherwise I would have been really rude to them. But I just couldn't believe that their watermark was there. And obviously it would have been shared however many times. And I was just really appalled.
No, that is disgusting. But it's so exploitative. And I think that we're going to see, I mean, I'm so ready to read Moya's Think piece about this because I'm sure she'll have to do one soon. But just about how, like, even if you don't want to be an activist, like what Instagram kind of makes you feel like you have to be in order to have some worthiness. And that's kind of another thing we need to get away from. It's like, actually, not everyone has to be an activist. Most people aren't really designed to be activists. You can be caring and give back to your community and try to be like as aware as you can be, but you really don't, like, we can't keep, it's become a new commodity in a way that I can't quite explain. But at one point where it would be like posting your brunch was like the thing to do on Instagram, it's like now the thing to do is make sure that you're up to date with the latest government coup that's happened wherever in the world. And it's making everyone, not only I can imagine, like 15-year-olds are probably anxious as fuck trying to make sure that they know like whatever's happened in Myanmar, whatever's happened wherever. And then everyone else has sort of got this, like you said, that false sense of security, like, oh good, I'm doing the right thing, I've shared that thing, I've signed that petition. And obviously all of these things are good, but they're not when they've just lost all meaning now, I think.
Yeah. Like, I'm someone who's very fed up with it. So I'm sure some people can, you know, launch a defense of like Instagram activism, but I'm particularly fed up with it. And I also don't like being, I'm often referred to as an activist, and I'm always like, I'm a writer. And obviously that always happens to minority writers. If you are a black writer who writes about black issues, or a gay writer who writes about gay issues, or a trans writer who writes about trans issues, then it means you're an activist. It's like, no, I'm not an activist, I'm a writer. And I do not want the responsibilities that come with activism. You know, activism comes with great personal sacrifices. I'm honest that I'm not ready or willing to make those sacrifices in my life, and I can accept that. And a lot of people need to accept that they're not. And that's fine. You know, there are people who will do that work and do that work, and you know, I will always support them and I back them, but it's okay to say that this is not my range, or like I don't have the bravery to do this. I think too much about my own security, my own safety to do that. And is it selfish? I guess we're all selfish. That's how things are. I think it also ends up devaluing some of the other work that you do. Like, some people are like, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a content creator, I'm a singer, I'm this and that. And I think that it means that, you know, as black people particularly, we're kind of just constrained to just this like realm of activism. And I also think that some people also really readily take up the label of activist as well, because it kind of it benefits them. And it's kind of like, I don't know if you can call yourself an activist and also do SponCon. I just don't think so. Like, I think that naturally, if you are an activist, you should be, you know, going against a lot of these different organizations. And this isn't me saying I'm better than you because you do SponCon. I've done SponCon before, but I'm also not calling myself an activist. I'm just a writer who writes about certain issues. I think that whole label, I think more people need to drop it from themselves, to be honest, and also people need to stop so readily attaching it to anyone who is just vocal on certain issues, because it's like, these are our lives, you know. And I think also, like, activism is always meant to be about the collective. I don't think that activists are meant to be named individuals. And I think that it's also part of the problem, again, in how history is taught, right? We're always taught about, you know, the individuals who did big things. So we're taught about, you know, MLK as an individual, Rosa Parks as an individual. We just don't learn enough about the kind of organisations and collective solidarity which goes into that. And even thinking to the United Kingdom, we don't have enough understanding and education about the trade union movement, for example, and the ways in which people organise throughout it, and, you know, strike and power and things like that, and how key gains were made collectively. I mean, if we talk about, say, like the poll tax and, you know, who led the poll, people can't name individuals who were leading the poll tax riots, or one activist individual who, you know, stood up to Thatcher. That was seen as a collective. That was seen as a story of a nation who fought back and said no more, right? Yeah. And I think that's missing, the fact that, you know, these activist stories are about communities. They're about collective work. They're about solidarity and radical change. They're not about this individual going and standing up and doing their own individual thing. And I get very tired of that.
I agree. I wonder if it's also just a limitation of language, where there's certain people who, especially someone who's really educated, really passionate, maybe like you, who understands like what like historical grassroots activism really meant. And then obviously young teenagers coming up now who really want to be activists. And I wonder if there's just a level of miscommunication. We need like a different word for what it is when you're online and sharing things, which also might take so much emotional labor and be really tiresome. And obviously like this whole question of accessibility of the online world, but there definitely is some sort of disjunct between, oh, there's just like a dearth of knowledge between what, you know, what activism is and what it's being presented as in like current standing.
Yeah.
The minute someone puts that label of activist on you, if you like try and, what, I don't know, buy a pair of shoes, they're like, well, you can't enjoy nice shoes because you're supposed to be being activist all the time. And it's like, no one even said that they were that. So and fun need to be like injected back into the story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people need to be able to, like, live, you know, like, holistic and balanced lives. Like, sometimes people follow me on social media for, like, you know, political tweets and when I'm, like, really riled up, and then they'll see me tweeting about something really trivial and they'll follow me, and it's like, well, I'm a 24-year-old boy. What do you want?
Yeah.
I've got a life outside of being angry at the government. So, yeah, I totally understand that, and I sympathise with the fact that, you know, you're kind of expected to always be on. And even people that I know who are, like, I know some people who actually, you know, organising, like, actual, like, radical activist collectives, they've still got lives, they still go on holiday, they still, you know, watch trash TV. They were watching the Meghan Harry Oprah interview, living for the drama, because, you know, we can't just stay angry all the time. We can't just, you know, constantly be doing that fight. So, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Totally. Now, your last thing that you wish been taught in school was public speaking, but judging by the last 1 hour and 26 minutes and 8 seconds, I think you're a fantastic public speaker. When did you get
I appreciate that. I think that I was kind of thinking about the ways in which, you know, I was taught to speak in school, and we only ever had, the only real practice we had for public speaking was debating society. And I really just, I always thought I should be good at debating because, you know, I'm argumentative and I have ideas, and I was always really bad at it because you had to like structure your argument in a certain way, and it was really just decorative and you had to take on a certain cause and it would be like A, B. I really couldn't stand the structure of it. And I think that it made me confused about how to speak publicly and how to like really articulate what I say verbally. And I remember just like, I remember being really bad at speaking for a long time. And I honestly, as much as you just like complimented me, I still think that I'm a really bad speaker. And I really like panic a lot of time with speaking because I'm always like, I might slur my words, or I might be speaking too fast, or I might not be saying things in like a certain coherent order. And I kind of just wish that there was more practice just for speaking freelance, because, you know, that's something that, you know, everyone has to do at some point. I mean, at most at school, you would have a presentation, but you would have everything written down and you pretend that you're not literally eyeing the whole thing the entire time. So, yeah, I kind of wish that there was more like workshops and opportunities to actually like practice speech and think about what makes good speech as well, rather than just the kind of like public school contortions of like a debating club, because that's not how people speak in real life, and that's not how people speak on public platforms either. Like what they're doing at the Cambridge Union is not a model for how conversations happen in society. So yeah, I wish I was better educated on public speaking.
I completely agree. When I first did, I got asked that TEDx talk and I was absolutely terrified. And so I learned a script and I did this PowerPoint. It's one of the worst things I've ever done, because I didn't really understand that like what makes a really good speech is actually just speaking from knowledge, trying to like draw from things that you know, speaking really freely. I guess like we have done on the podcast, such kind of the best way to listen to someone is listen to that natural flow of conversation. But it is such a hard skill. And I definitely find it even now, like I've done so many episodes of this podcast, and now I'm thinking about what I'm saying. It does make you really self-conscious, and suddenly all the words jumble up and your brain can't think of what you're going to say next. And it is something, as you say, that everyone's going to have to do, even if it's like it's your brother's wedding, you have to do a speech. Everyone at some point in their life is going to have to do a speech. And yeah, we are really ill-equipped, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really necessary skill, and I think it's something that lots of people feel anxious about, you know, the need to, you know, be able to speak publicly. And I think the time I really challenged it was that, you know, it was my dad's funeral and I'd written out a speech to write and I was really struggling with it, and I just threw it away and I just spoke about my father freely and what I remembered about him. And I think that from now on, like with my speeches, I might write down like a few prompts to say, you know, I need to talk about this, but I just don't think I will ever write out a whole speech again unless I really had to, because it will always feel unnatural, it will always feel really artificial, and it will always feel like you're confusing and jumbling yourself. And I think that part of good public speaking is also trusting yourself and trusting your brain as well. Like even now throughout this entire podcast conversation, I mean, being honest, I was in bed before being like, shit, what am I going to say? But I've now just come here and I thought, you know, I have, you know, some thoughts, and what I say can then spiral into other things. And, you know, the host will prompt me or ask certain questions and that will inspire certain things. And so remembering that, you know, our brains hold so much more than some A4 sheets of paper ever can. And our brains are the best resource for what we can say, because, you know, we're always thinking to ourselves, we're always speaking to ourselves and in dialogue and in conversations with ourselves all the time. And speaking in public isn't all that different. It's just thinking about it at a certain vibrancy and at a certain consistency.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast the other day actually with a comedian who's talking about how she does improv classes, and she was saying, like you just said, it's really sweet. We walk around all day improvising to ourselves. We're just having a little chat in our head all day long, and we completely forget that, as you say, our brain's able to jump from idea to idea and it makes perfect sense. Whereas weirdly, writing and speaking is such different skills. And if you wrote something down that you were going to say out loud, it sometimes actually comes out really clunky, because our brains make these really amazing segues that you couldn't necessarily get to in writing. They kind of are twindly and turny, but when you're listening, it flows very nicely.
And it is
really free. I loved having these conversations, because I think it's actually really fun to see where your brain goes, but it's exhausting. Like, we'll be really tired after this, because your brain has just been like going all over the shop.
I mean, I didn't imagine that we would be talking about influencers in this conversation, but I quite enjoyed that discussion. I thought it was good, and yeah, it does show the kind of like, when your discussions are organic, it can take you to really exciting places, and when they're not really fixed down. So I like the format of this, where you said, you know, just three things that you wish you learned in school, because it allows lots of different prompts, and it allowed me to, even that memory of, you know, my teacher who I knew was a lesbian, who I, you know, I haven't actually thought about that memory in a really long time, but I was just reminded of it. And so, yeah, I like the creativity of the brain and where it can take you, rather than just being really like super prepared and being like, I'm going to say this, 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 and this.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes you listen to journalist interviews and that, not to say that I'm better than other journalists, because I definitely am not, but you know, when you would like, oh my God, they're about to say something really interesting, and then the journalist goes, okay, so anyway, and then has like a really specific question to ask. And you're like, oh my God, if you just said like, what did you mean by that? You could have had like an amazing conversation about the muffin they have for lunch or whatever it might be.
That's an interesting thing that happened. So last week I was interviewing some of the mayoral candidates for the Black Cultural Archive. So I interviewed the Labour, Green and Liberal Democrat candidate. And so Sean Berry was my best interview, the Green candidate, because it was just like a free flowing conversation. So what it was that all of the candidates get like a set list of questions. But for Sean Berry's and Louisa Porritt's conversations, the Green Liberal Democrat candidate, I was allowed to kind of follow up more. And so we ended up having more interesting conversation back and forth. forth, and I was able to like challenge and I asked questions that I wasn't expecting to ask them, and also that they weren't expecting to be answered as well. So, you know, they were having to speak more organically. So at some points they had to kind of break out of their script. But the interview with Sadiq Khan, oh my God. So it was shorter because he only had like a certain amount of time, but also his team like sent us like a very fixed set list of questions and said you could only ask these 7 questions, and I was allowed to follow up. And so there was a point where he said something like his answer to like police brutality was more black police officers, and I wanted to follow up on that. I wanted to interrogate that and have a discussion, you know, is representation really what you're offering to young black Londoners, and you know, are more black police officers actually going to solve the issue, or are they going to be a kind of like cosmetic diversity cover-up? And that would have been a very interesting conversation for me to have with the mayor, but because we were restricted to just having to, you know, keep it to the 7 questions, I had to move on. And I was really, really frustrated actually, because I wanted to be able to have that dialogue, and I think it would have been better for the both of us. And I also actually think he would have come across better as well if he had allowed that space to engage in that dialogue and actually present himself as someone open to challenge. Because you know what, Sean Berry, I challenged her on some things. I was like, you know, I didn't like, you know, when this has been said by the Green Party. So I challenged her on some things that the Green Party have said in the hell out of me, and she was able to actually respond to it and give me an honest answer as well. And I like that.
I think that's so cool. And also you're right, I would be fascinated to see what he said about that, because obviously like people who perhaps haven't gone into this idea of like abolishing the police or what that could really look like, or why there's no such thing as like a rotten apple, it's a rotten system, etc. It would have been interesting to see him take that on. And it's a shame how the PR machine then sort of takes over, because you don't know how much it's him going, oh, I don't want to answer anything, or people going, look, we're going to completely like put up barriers so that people can't like catch you out. And then it's just a shame, because you're right, what are we voting for then if we can't really get inside your brain and understand what you really think about things? It kind of changes, it just becomes a PR stunt again, doesn't it?
It's like, if I want the PR answer, I will just read your manifesto, but I just don't think that's what interviews should be like. Anything that, you know, you've got prepared should already be out to the public, and interviews should be able to, they should be able to catch you off guard. They should be able to ask you the difficult questions. I don't think a politician should be able to prepare for an interview beyond remembering their numbers or something like that, or key things in their manifesto, but they should be able to have pre-prepared lines for everything that's said. You know, they should be open, and I think that we would have much better conversations with politicians, because also sometimes a politician comes off worse when they're trying to just repeat a line that they had set and it doesn't answer the question that they're being asked, and they think it's fine because they've taken control, but they just look stupid to most people and they look incompetent. So
I agree, that's very interesting. And where can we get these interviews? Are they out yet, your interviews?
Yes, they're on the Black Cultural Archives YouTube, so you can watch them there with the Labour, Green and Liberal Democrat candidate. Unfortunately, I was meant to interview the Conservative candidate, Sean Bailey, but I was taken off it and it was given to another journalist. I reckon that they searched me up and they were scared. So that's what I'm thinking, but I don't know why.
I would have loved to see your interview, because I'd be interested to see what accent he did if you interviewed him.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. His interview with ZZ Mills was, like, painful, because it was like, where did you rent this accent from?
I had to pause it and get a YouTube video up to remind myself. I was like, am I going mad? Like, I'm like, does he normally speak? I swear he doesn't normally speak like this. So I got, like, another interview up and watched it. And then I played it back and I was like, oh, my God. What is going on?
It was shocking. Well, we'll see how the results play out today.
Thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure. Sorry to keep you so long. Do you have anything that you wish to...
Oh, no, it's totally fine.
Do you want to point anyone in the direction of anything? You've obviously got your book coming out in 2024, is it? Should I get that right?
Yeah, so my book, Revolutionary Acts, which is a social history of Black gay men, will be out in 2024. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Jace by Jason, which is a play on Mark by Mark Jacobs. That's the joke.
Got you.
And And also our digital archive, Black and Gay Back in the Day, which I run with Mark Thompson, who you should also check out because he does some really excellent work with HIV prevention. And he was recently on a BBC2 programme called Saved by a Stranger, where he reunites with the therapist who helped him when he was a young man recently diagnosed with HIV. So, yeah.
Wow.
I have to plug.
Amazing. I'm trying to think if I saw an article about that the other day. Maybe it did. Anyway, irrelevant. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you. As I said, you only got on, like, we're recording this like 4 p.m. on Friday, which is probably like the worst time to be doing an interview. But I've actually really perked up now because I feel like it was such a nice chat. So thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you everyone for listening. I will see you next week. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.